The Memoirs of David Brainerd, Chapter 12. From the termination of his missionary labors to his death. On Friday, March 20th, 1747, about 11 a.m., he left Cranberry, little suspecting that he saw it and his beloved people for the last time. On Saturday, he came to Elizabethtown, enfeebled in health and oppressed with melancholy. Here he continued a considerable time, laboring under the ravages of disease and suffering from extreme depression of spirit. March 28th, was taken this morning with violent gripping pains. These pains were extreme and constant for several hours, so that it seemed impossible for me, without a miracle, to live 24 hours in such distress. I lay confined to my bed the whole day and in distressing pain, all the former part of it, but it pleased God to bless means by the abatement of my distress, was exceedingly weakened by this pain, and continued so for several days following, being exercised with a fever, cough, and nocturnal sweats. It, in this distressed case, so long as my head was free of vapory confusions, death appeared agreeable to me. I looked on it as the end of toils and an entrance into a place where the weary are at rest, and I think I had some relish for the entertainments of the heavenly state, so that by these I was allured and drawn, as well as driven by the fatigues of life. Oh, how happy it is to be drawn by desires of a state of perfect holiness. April 4th, was sunk and dejected, very restless and uneasy, by reason of the misimprovement of time, and yet knew not what to do. I longed to spend time in fasting and prayer, that I might be delivered from indolence and coldness of in the things of God. But alas, I had not bodily strength for these exercises. Oh, how blessed a thing it is to enjoy peace of conscience. But how dreadful is a want of inward peace and composure of soul. It is impossible, I find, to enjoy happiness without redeeming time and maintaining a spiritual frame of mind. Lord's Day, April 5th. It grieved me to find myself so inconceivably barren. My soul thirsts for grace, but alas, how far was I from obtaining what appeared to me so exceeding excellent? I was ready to despair of ever being a holy creature, and yet my soul was delirious of following hard after God, but never did I see myself so far from having apprehended or being already perfect as at this time. The Lord's Supper being this day administered, I attended the ordinances, and though I saw in myself a dreadful emptiness and want of grace, and saw myself as it were at an infinite distance from that purity which becomes the gospel, yet at the communion, especially at the distribution of the bread, I enjoyed some warmth of affection and felt a tender love to the brethren, and I think to the glorious Redeemer, the firstborn among them. I endeavored then to bring mine forth and his enemies, and slay them before him, and found great freedom in begging deliverances from this spiritual death, as well as in asking divine favors for my friends and congregation and the Church of Christ in general. April 7th, in the afternoon, rode to Newark to marry the Reverend Mr. Dickinson. Footnote: the late learned and very excellent Mr. Jonathan Dickinson, pastor of a church in Elizabethtown, president of the College of New Jersey, and one of the correspondents of the Honorable Society in Scotland for propagating Christian knowledge. He had a great esteem for Brainerd, kindly entertained him in his house during his sickness the winter past, and after a short illness, died the ensuing October, 2 days before Brainerd. End of footnote. In the evening, performed that service. Afterwards, rode home to Elizabethtown in a pleasant frame, full of composure and sweetness. April 9th, attended the ordination of Mr. Tucker, footnote, and afterwards the examination of Mr. Smith. Was in a comfortable frame of mind this day, and felt my heart, I think, sometimes in a spiritual frame. Footnote now. A worthy, pious young man, Mr. Tucker is, who lived in the ministry but a very short time. He died at Stratfield in Connecticut, the December following his ordination, a little while after Brainerd's death at Northampton. He was taken ill on a journey, returning from a visit to his friends at Milton in Massachusetts, which, as I take it, was his native place, and Harvard College, the place of his education. End of footnote. April 10th, spent the forenoon in Presbytery business. In the afternoon, rode to Elizabethtown, found my brother John there, footnote, spent some time in conversation with him, but was extremely weak and outdone. My spirits considerably sunk, and my mind dejected. Now, footnote, this brother of his had been sent for by the correspondents to take care of and instruct Brenner's congregation of Indians, he being obliged by his illness to be absent from them. He continued to take care of them till Brenner's death, and since his death has been ordained his successor in his mission, and to the charge of his congregation, which continues much to flourish under his pastoral care. End of the footnote. April 13th, assisted in examining my brother. In the evening was in a solemn, devout frame, but was much overdone and oppressed with a violent headache. April 14th, was able to do little or nothing. Spent some time with Mr. Brenham and other friends. This day, my brother went to my people. April 15th, found some freedom at the throne of grace several times this day. In the afternoon, was very weak and spent the time in very little purpose, yet in the evening had, I thought, some religious warmth and spiritual desires in prayer. My soul seemed to go forth after God and take complacency in his divine perfections. But alas, afterwards awfully let down my watch and grew careless and secure. April 16th, was in bitter anguish of soul in the morning, such as I have scarce ever felt, with a sense of sin and guilt. I continued in distress the whole day, attempting to pray wherever I went, and indeed could not help so doing, but looked upon myself so vile that I dared not look anybody in the face, and was even grieved that anybody should show me any respect, or that they should be so deceived as to think I deserved it. April 17th, in the evening, could not but think that God helped me to draw near to the throne of grace, though most unworthy, and gave me a sense of his favor, which gave me inexpressible support and encouragement, though I scarcely dared to hope that the mercy was real, it appeared so great. Yet could not but rejoice that even God should discover his reconciled face to such a vile sinner. Shame and confusion at times covered me, and then hope and joy and admiration of divine goodness gained the ascendant. Sometimes I could not but admire the divine goodness that the Lord had not let me fall into all the grossest and vilest acts of sins and open scandal that could be thought of, and felt so much necessitated to praise God that this was ready for a little while to swallow up my shame and pressure of spirit on account of my sins, unquote. After this, his dejection and pressure of spirit returned, and he remained under it the two next days. April 20th, was in a very disordered state and kept my bed most of the day. I enjoyed a little more comfort than in several of the preceding days. This day, I arrived at the age of 29 years. April 21st, I set out on my journey for New England in order, if it might be the will of God, to recover my health by riding, travel to New York, and there lodged. This proved his final departure from New Jersey. He traveled slowly and arrived among his friends at East Haddam about the beginning of May. There is very little count in his diary of the time that passed from this his setting out on his journey on May 10th. He speaks of his sometimes finding his heart rejoicing in the glorious perfections of God and longing to live to him, but complains of the unfitness of his thoughts and their being easy diverted from divine subjects, and cries out of his leanness as testifying against him in the loudest manner. Concerning those diversions which he was obliged to use for his health, he says that he sometimes found he could use diversions with singleness of heart, aiming at the glory of God, but that he also found there was a necessity of great care and watchfulness, lest he should lose that spiritual temper of his mind in his diversions, and lest they should degenerate into what was merely selfish without any supreme aim at the glory of God in him. Lord's Day, May 10th, at Hadline, footnote, a parish of Haddam in Connecticut, end of footnote. I could not but feel some measure of gratitude to God at this time, wherein I was much exercised, that he had always disposed me in my ministry to insist on the greatest doctrines of regeneration, the new creature, faith in Christ, progressive sanctification, supreme love to God, living entirely to the glory of God, being not our own, and the like. God thus helped me to see, in the surest manner, from time to time, that these, and the like doctrines necessarily connected with them, are the only foundation of safety and salvation for perishing sinners, and that those divine dispositions which are constant hereto are that holiness, quote, without which no man shall see the Lord, unquote, the exercise of these godlike tempers, wherein the soul acts in a kind of concert with God, and would be and do everything that is pleasing to him, I saw would stand by the soul in a dying hour, for God must, I think, deny himself, if he cast away his own image, even the soul that is one in desires with himself. Lord's Day, May 17th, at Millington, footnote, a parish of East Haddam in Connecticut, end of footnote, spent the forenoon at home, being unable to attend public worship. At this time, God gave me such an affecting sense of my own vileness and the exceeding sinfulness of my heart that there seemed to be nothing but sin and corruption within me. Innumerable evils compassed me about, my want of spirituality and holy living, my neglect of God and living to myself. All the abominations of my heart and life seemed to be open to my view, and I had nothing to say but, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Towards noon, I saw that the grace of God in Christ is infinitely free towards sinners and such sinners as I was. I also saw that God is the supreme good, that in his presence is life, and I began to long to die that I might be with him in a state of freedom from all sin. Oh, how a small glimpse of his excellency refreshed my soul. Oh, how worthy is the blessed God to be loved, adored, and delighted in, for himself, for his own divine excellences. Though I felt much dullness and want of a spirit of prayer this week, yet I had some glimpses of the excellencies of divine things, and especially one morning, in secret meditation and prayer, the excellency and beauty of holiness as a longingness, the likeness to the glorious God was so discovered to me that I began to long earnestly to be in that world where holiness dwells in perfection. I seemed to long for this perfect holiness, not so much for the sake of my own happiness, although I saw clearly that this was the greatest, yea, the only happiness of the soul, as that I might please God, live entirely to him, and glorify him to the utmost stretch of my rational powers and capacities. Lord's Day, May 24th, at Longmeadow in Massachusetts, could not but think, as I have often remarked it to others, that much more of true religion consists in deep humility, brokenness of heart, and an abasing sense of barrenness and want of grace and holiness than most who are called Christians. Imagine, especially those who have been esteemed the converts of the late day. Many seem to know of no other religion but elevated joys and affections, arising only from some flights of imagination or some suggestion made to their mind of Christ being theirs, God loving them, and the like. On Thursday, May 28, he came from Longmeadow to Northampton, appearing vastly better than, by his account, he had been in the winter, indeed so well that he was able to ride 25 miles in a day, and to walk half a mile, and appeared cheerful and free from melancholy, but yet undoubtedly at that time in a confirmed incurable consumption. I had much opportunity before this of particular information concerning him from many who were well acquainted with him, and had myself once an opportunity of considerable conversation and some acquaintance with him at New Haven near 4 years before, at the time of the commencement, when he offered that confession to the rector of the college, which has been already mentioned in this history, having been one whom he was pleased then several times to consult on that affair, but now I had opportunity for a more full acquaintance with him. I found him remarkably sociable, pleasant, and entertaining in his conversations, yet solid, savory, spiritual, and very profitable. He appeared meek, modest, and humble, far from any stiffness, monroseness, superstitious demureness, or affected singularity in speech or behavior, and seemingly to dislike all such things. We enjoyed not only the benefit of his conversion, but had the comfort and we enjoyed not only the benefit of his conversation, but had the comfort and advantage of hearing him pray in the family from time to time. His manner of praying was very agreeable, most becoming a worm in the dust and a disciple of Christ, addressing an infinitely great and holy God, Father of mercies, not with florid expressions or studied eloquence, not with any intemperate vehemence or indecent boldness. It was at a great distance from any appearance of obstination and from everything that might look as though he meant to recommend himself to those that were about him, or to set himself off to their acceptancy. It was free also from vain repetitions, without impertinent excursions or needless multiplying of words. He expressed himself with the strictest propriety, with weight and pungency, and yet what his lips uttered seemed to flow from the fullness of his heart, as deeply impressed with a great and solemn sense of our necessities, unworthiness, and dependency, and of God's infinite greatness, excellency, and sufficiency, rather than merely from a warm and fruitful brain pouring out good expressions. I know not that I ever heard him so much as ask a blessing or return thanks at the table, but there was something remarkable to be observed both in the matter and manner of the performance. In his prayers, he insisted much on the prosperity of Zion, the advancement of Christ's kingdom in the world, and the flourishing and propagation of religion among the Indians. And he generally made it one petition in his prayer, that we might not outlive our usefulness. Lord's Day, May 31st, at Northampton. I had little inward sweetness in religion. Most of the week passed, not realizing and beholding spiritually the glory of God and the Blessed Redeemer, from whence always arise my comforts and joys in religion. If I have any will at all, and if I cannot so behold the excellencies and perfections of God as to cause me to rejoice in Him for what He is in Himself, I have no solid foundation for joy. To rejoice only because I apprehended I have an interest in Christ and shall be finally saved is a poor, mean business indeed. This week he consulted Dr. Matters at my house concerning his illness, who plainly told him that there were great evidences of his being in a confirmed consumption, and that he could give him no encouragement that he should ever recover. But it seemed not to occasion the least discomposure to him, in him, nor to make any manner of alteration as to the cheerfulness and serenity of his mind, or the freedom or pleasantness of his conversation. Lord's Day, June 7th. My attention was greatly engaged, and my soul still drawn forth this day, by what I heard of the exceeding preciousness of the saving grace of God's Spirit, that it almost overwhelmed my body in my weak state. I saw that true grace is exceedingly precious indeed, that it is very rare, and that there is but a very small degree of it, even where the reality of it is to be found. At least I saw this to be my case. In the preceding week, I enjoyed some comfortable seasons of meditation. One morning, the cause of God appeared exceedingly precious to me. The Redeemer's kingdom is all that is valuable in the earth, and I could not but long for the promotion of it in the world. I saw also that this cause is God's, that He has an infinitely greater regard and concern for it than I could possibly have, that if I have any true love to this blessed interest, it is only a drop derived from that ocean. Hence, I was ready to lift up my head with joy and conclude, well, if God's cause be so dear and precious to Him, He will promote it. Thus I did, as it were, rest on God, that He would surely promote that which was so agreeable to His own will, though the time when must still be left to His sovereign pleasure. He was advised by the physician still to continue writing, as what would tend above all other means to prolong his life. He was at a loss for some time which way to bend his course next, but finally determined to ride from hence to Boston, we having concluded that one of our family should go with him and be helpful to him in his weak and low state. June 9th, I set out on a journey from Northampton to Boston, traveled slowly, and got some acquaintance with divers ministers on the road. Having now continued to ride for some considerable time together, I found myself much better than I had formerly done, and found that in proportion to the prospect I had of being restored to a state of usefulness, so I desired the continuance of life. But death appeared inconceivably more desirable to me than a useless life. Yet, blessed be God, I found my heart at times fully resigned and reconciled to this greatest of afflictions, if God saw fit thus to dwell with me. June 12th. I arrived in Boston this day, somewhat fatigued from my journey. Observe that there is no rest but in God. Fatigues of body and anxious anxieties of mind attend us both in town and country. No place is exempt. Lord's Day, June 14th. I enjoyed some enlargement and sweetness in family prayer, as well as in secret exercises. God appeared excellent, his ways full of pleasure and peace, and all I wanted was a spirit of holy fervency to live to him. June 17th. This and the two preceding days I spent mainly in visiting the ministers of the town, and was treated with great respect by them. June 18th. I was taken exceedingly ill and brought to the gates of death by the breaking of small ulcers in my lungs, as my physician supposed. In this extremely weak state, I continued for several weeks and was frequently reduced so low as to be utterly speechless and not able so much as to whisper a word, even after I had so far revived as to walk about the house and to step out of doors. I was exercised every day with a faint turn, which continued usually 4 or 5 hours, at which times, though I was not so utterly speechless, but that I could say yes or no, yet I could not converse at all, nor speak one sentence without making stops for breath, and divers times this season, my friends gathered round my bed to see my breath, to see me breathe my last, which they expected every moment, as I myself did. How I was the first day or two of my illness with regard to due the exercise of reason, I scarcely know. I believe I was somewhat shattered with the violency of a fever at times, but the third day of my illness and constantly afterwards, for 4 or 5 weeks together, I enjoyed as much serenity of mind and clearness of thought as perhaps I ever did in my life. I think that my mind never penetrated with so much ease and freedom into divine things as at this time, and I never felt so capable of demonstrating the truth of many important doctrines of the gospel as now. As I saw clearly the truth of those great doctrines, which are justly styled the doctrines of grace, so I saw with no less clearness that the essence of religion consisted in the soul's conformity to God, and acting above all selfish views for his glory, longing to be for him, to live to him, and please and honor him in all things, and this from a clear view of his infinite excellency and worthiness in himself to be loved, adored, worshipped, and served by all intelligent creatures. Thus I saw that when a soul loves God with a supreme love, he therein acts like the blessed God himself, who most justly loves himself in that manner. So when God's interests and his are become one, and he longs that God should be glorified, and rejoices to think that he is unchangeably possessed of the highest glory and blessedness herein, also he acts in conformity to God. In like manner, when the soul is fully resigned to, and rests satisfied and content with the divine will, here it is also conformed to God. I saw further that as this divine temper by which the soul exalts God and trends self in the dust is wrought in the soul by God's discovering his own glorious perfections in the face of Jesus Christ to it, by the special influences of the Holy Spirit, so he cannot but have regard to it as his own work, and as it is his image in the soul, he cannot but take delight in it. Then I saw again that if God should slight and reject his own mortal image, he must needs deny himself, which he cannot do. And thus I saw the stability and infallibility of this religion, and that those who are truly possessed of it have the most complete and satisfying evidences of their being interested in all the benefits of Christ's redemption, having their hearts conformed to Him, and that these only are qualified by the employments and entertainments of God's kingdom of glory, as none but these have any relish for the business of heaven, which to ascribe glory to God and not to themselves, and that God, though I would speak it with great reverency of His name and perfection, cannot, without denying Himself, finally cast such away. The next thing I had then to do was to inquire whether this was my religion, and here God was pleased to help me to the most easy remembrances and critical review of what had passed in course of a religious nature, though several in the latter years of my life. Although I could discover much corruption attending my best duties, many selfish views and carnal ends, much spiritual pride and self-exaltation, and innumerable other evils which compassed me about, yet God was pleased, as I was reviewing, quickly to put this question out of doubt, by showing me that I had, from time to time, acted above the utmost influence of mere self-love, that I had longed to please and glorify Him as my highest happiness, etc. This review was, through grace, attended with the present feeling of the same divine temper of mine. I felt now pleased to think of the glory of God, and longed for heaven as a state wherein I might glorify God perfectly, rather than a place of happiness for myself. This feeling of the love of God in my heart, which I trust the Spirit of God excited in me afresh, was sufficient to give me a full satisfaction and make me long, as I had many times before done, to be with Christ. I did not now want any of the sudden suggestions which many are so pleased with, that Christ and His benefits are mine, that God loves me, etc., in order to give me satisfaction about my state. No, my soul now abhorred those delusions of Satan, which I thought to be the immediate witness of the Spirit, while there is nothing but an empty suggestion of a certain fact, without any gracious discovery of the divine glory, or of the Spirit's work in their own hearts. I saw the awful delusion of this kind of confidence, as well as the whole of that religion, from which they usually spring, or at least of which they are the attendants. The false religion of the late day, though a day of wondrous grace, the imagination, the impressions made only of the animal affections, together with the sudden suggestions made to the mind by Satan, transformed into an angel of light, of certain facts not revealed in Scripture, and many such like things, I fear, have made up the greater part of the religious appearance in many places. These things I saw with great clearness when I was thought to be dying. God gave me great concern for His church and interest in the world at this time, not so much because the late remarkable influence upon the minds of people was abated, as because that false religion, those hearts of imagination and wild and selfish commotion of the animal affections which attended the work of grace had prevailed so far. This was that which my mind dwelt upon almost day and night, and this, to me, was the darkest appearance respecting religion in the land, for it was this, chiefly, that had prejudiced the world against inward religion, and I saw the great mystery of all was that so few saw any manner of difference between those exercises which are spiritual and holy, and those which have self-love only for the beginning, center, and end. As God was pleased to afford me clearness of thought and composure of mind almost continually for several weeks together under my great weakness, so He enabled me in some measure to improve my time, as I hope, to valuable purposes. I was enabled to write a number of important letters to friends in remote places, and sometimes I wrote when I was speechless, an example, unable to maintain conversation with anybody, though perhaps I was able to speak a word or two so as to be heard. Among the letters written at this period were the following. The reader will perceive that they were written by one conscious that he was standing at the verge of the grave and realizing in no ordinary degree the infinite importance of eternity. To his brother Israel at college, written in the time of his extreme illness in Boston, a few months before his death. Boston, June 30th, 1747. My dear brother, it is on the verge of eternity I now address you. I am heartily sorry that I have so little strength to write what I long so much to communicate to you. But let me tell you, my brother, eternity is another thing than we ordinarily take it to be in a healthful state. O how vast and boundless! O how fixed and unalterable! O of what infinite importance it is that we be prepared for eternity! I have been just a dying, now for more than a week, and all around me have thought me so. I have had clear views of eternity, have seen the blessedness of the godly in some measure, and have longed to share their happy state, as well as been comfortably satisfied that through grace I should do so. But oh, what anguish is raised in my mind to think of eternity for those who are Christless, for those who are mistaken, and who bring their false hopes to the grave with them. The sight was so dreadful, I could by no means bear it. My thoughts recoiled, and I said, under a more affecting sense than ever before, who can dwell with everlasting burnings? Oh, methought, could I now see my friends, that I might warn them to see to it that they lay their foundation for eternity sure. And for you, my dear brother, I have been particularly concerned and have wondered. I so much neglected conversing with you about your spiritual state at our last meeting. Oh, my brother, let me then beseech you now to examine whether you are indeed a new creature, whether you have ever acted above self, whether the glory of God has ever been the sweetest and highest concern for you and the highest concern with you, whether you have ever been reconciled to all the perfections of God. In a word, whether God has been your portion and a holy conformity to Him your chief delight. If you cannot answer positively concerning seriously the frequent breathings of your soul, but do not, however, put yourself off with a slight answer. If you have reason to think you are graceless, oh, give yourself and the throne of grace no rest till God arise and say, and if the case should be otherwise, bless God for His grace and press after holiness. Footnote. Brennan afterwards had greater satisfaction concerning the state of his brother's soul by much opportunity of conversation with him before his death. End of footnote. My soul longs that you should be fitted for and in due time go into the work of the ministry. I cannot bear to think of your going into any other business in life. Do not be discouraged because you see your elder brothers in the ministry die early, one after another. I declare, now I am dying. I would not have spent my life otherwise for the whole world, but I must leave this with God. If this line should come to your hands soon after the date, I should be almost desirous you should set out on a journey to me. It may be you may see me alive, which I should much rejoice in, but if you cannot come, I must commit you to the grace of God where you are. May He be your guide and counselor, your sanctifier and eternal portion. Oh, my dear brother, flee fleshly lust and the enchanting amusements as well as corrupt doctrines of the present day, and strive to live to God. Take this as the last line from your affectionate dying brother, David Brennan. To a young gentleman, a candidate for the work of the ministry, for whom he had a special friendship, also written at the same time of his great illness and nearness to death in Boston. Very dear sir, how amazing it is that the living who know they must die should, notwithstanding, put far away the evil in a season of health and prosperity, and live at such an awful distance from a familiarity with the grave and the great concerns beyond it, especially it may justly fill us with surprise that any whose minds have been divinely enlightened to behold the important things of eternity as they are, I say, that such should live in this manner. And yet, sir, how frequently is this the case? How rare are the instances of those who live and act from day to day, as on the verge of eternity, striving to fill up all their remaining moments in the service and to the honor of their great master. We insensibly trifle away time while we seem to have enough of it, and are so strangely amused as in a great measure to lose a sense of the holiness and blessed qualifications necessary to prepare us to be inhabitants of the heavenly paradise. But, oh, dear sir, a dying bed, if we enjoy our reason clearly, we'll give another view of things. I have now, for more than 3 weeks, lain under the greatest degree of weakness, the greater part of the time expecting daily and hourly to enter into the eternal world. Sometimes have been so far gone as to be wholly speechless for some hours together. Oh, of what vast importance has a holy spiritual life appeared to me at this season. I have longed to call upon all my friends to make it their business to live to God, and especially all that are designed for or engaged in the service of the sanctuary. Oh, dear sir, do not think it enough to live at the rate of common Christians. Alas, to how little purpose do they often converse when they meet together. The visits, even of those who are called Christians indeed, are frequently extremely barren, and conscience cannot but condemn us for the misimprovement of time while we have been conversant with them. But the way to enjoy the divine presence and to be fitted for the distinguishing service for God is to live a life of great devotion and constant self-dedication to Him, observing the motions and dispositions of our own hearts, whence we may learn the corruptions that lodge there and our constant need of help from God for the performance of the least duty. And, O dear sir, let me beseech you frequently to attend the great and precious duties of secret fasting and prayer. I have a secret thought from some things I have observed that God may perhaps design you for some singular service in the world. Oh, then labor to be prepared and qualified to do much for God. Read Mr. Edwards' piece on the affections again and again, and labor to distinguish clearly from experiences and affections in religion, that you may make a difference between the gold and the shining dross. I say, labor here, if ever you would be a useful minister of Christ, for nothing has put such a stop to the work of God in the late day as the false religion and the wild affections which attend it. Suffer me, therefore, finally to entreat you earnestly to give yourself to prayer, to reading and meditation on divine things. Strive to penetrate to the bottom of them, and never be content with a superficial knowledge. By this means, your thoughts will gradually grow weighty and judicious, and you hereby will be possessed by a valuable treasure, out of which you may produce things new and old to the glory of God. And now, I commend you to the grace of God, earnestly desiring that a plentiful portion of the divine spirit may rest upon you, that you may live to God in every capacity of life, and do abundant service for him and a public one, if it be his will, and that you may be richly qualified for the inheritance of the saints in light. I scarce expect to see your face any more in the body, and therefore entreat you to accept this as a last token of love from your sincerely affectionate dying friend, David Brennard. P.S. I am now, at the date of this letter, considerably recovered from what I was when I wrote it, it having lain by me some time for want of an opportunity of conveyancing. It was written in Boston. I am now able to write a little, and so am removed into the country, but have no more expectations of recovering than when I wrote, though I am a little better for the present, and therefore I still subscribe myself, your dying friend, etc., D.B. To his brother John at Bethel, the town of Christian Indians in New Jersey, written likewise at Boston when he was there on the brink of the grave in the summer before his death. Dear brother, I am now just on the verge of eternity, expecting very speedily to appear in the unseen world. I feel myself no more an inhabitant of earth, and sometimes earnestly long to depart and be with Christ. I bless God, He has for some years given me an abiding conviction that it is impossible for any rational creature to enjoy true happiness without being entirely devoted to Him. Under the influence of this conviction, I have in some measure acted. Oh, that I had done more so. I saw both the excellency and necessity of holiness in life, but never in such a manner as now, when I am just brought from the sides of the grave. O, my brother, pursue after holiness. Press towards this blessed mark, and let your thirsty soul continually say, I shall never be satisfied till I awake in thy likeness. Although there has been a great delight of selfishness in my views, of which I am ashamed, and for which my soul is humbled at every view, yet, blessed be God, I find I have really had, for the most part, such a concern for his glory, and for the advancement of his kingdom in the world, that it is a satisfaction to me to reflect upon these years. And now, my dear brother, as I must press you to pursue after personal holiness, to be as much in fasting and prayer as your health will allow, and to live above the rate of common Christians, so I must entreat you solemnly to attend to your public work, labor to distinguish between true and false religion, and to that end watch the motions of God's Spirit upon your own heart. Look to Him for help, and impartially compare your experiences with His Word. Read Mr. Edwards on the affections, where the essence and soul of religion is clearly distinguished from false affections. Footnote. I had at first fully intended in publishing this and the foregoing letters to have suppressed these passages wherein my name is mentioned, and my discourse on religious affections recommended, and I am sensible that by my doing otherwise I shall bring upon me the reproach of some. But how much soever I may be pleased with the accommodation of any performance of mine, and I confess I esteem the judgment and appropriation of such a person as Brainerd worthy to be valued and looked on myself as highly honored by it, yet I can truly say the things that govern me in altering my forementioned determination with respect to these passages were these two. Number one, what Brainerd here says of that discourse shows very fully and particularly what his notions were of experimental religion and the nature of true piety and how far he was from placing it in impressions on the imagination or any enthusiastic impulses and how essential in religion he esteemed holy practice, etc., etc. For all that have read that discourse know what sentiments are there expressed concerning those things. Number two, I judged that the approbation of so apparent and eminent a friend, an example of inward vital religion and evangelical piety in the height of it, would probably tend to make that book more serviceable, especially among some kinds of zealous persons, whose benefit was especially aimed at in the book, some of which are prejudiced against it, as written in too legal a strain, in opposing some things within the height of Christian experience, consist in tending to build men upon their own works. End of the footnote. Value religious joys according to the subject matter of them. There are many who rejoice in their supposed justification, but what do these joys argue? But only that they love themselves. Whereas, in true spiritual joys, the soul rejoices in God for what he is in himself, blesses God for his holiness, sovereignty, power, faithfulness, and all his perfections, adores God that he is what he is, that he is unchangeably possessed of infinite glory and happiness. Now, when men thus rejoice in the perfections of God and in the infinite excellency of the way of salvation by Christ, and in the holy commands of God, which are a transcript of his holy nature, these joys are divine and spiritual. Our joys will stand by us at the hour of death, if we can be then satisfied that we have thus acted above self, and in a disinterested manner, if I may so express it, rejoiced in the glory of the blessed God. I fear you are not sufficiently aware how much false religion there is in the world. Many serious Christians and valuable ministers are too easily imposed upon by this false blaze. I likewise fear you are not sensible of the dreadful effects and consequences of this false religion. Let me tell you, it is the devil transformed into an angel of light. It is a fiend of hell that always springs up with every revival of religion and stabs and murders the cause of God while it passes current with multitudes of well-meaning people for the height of religion. Set yourself, my brother, to crush all appearances of this nature among the Indians and never encourage any degrees of heat without light. Charge my people in the name of their dying minister, yea, in the name of him who is dead and is alive, to live and walk as becomes the gospel. Tell them how great the expectations of God and his people are from them, and how awfully they will wound God's cause if they fall into vice as well as fatally prejudice over other poor Indians. Always insist that their experiences are rotten, that their joys are delusive, although they may have been wrapped up into the third heavens in their own conceit by them, unless the main tenure of their lives be spiritual, watchful, and holy. Impressing these things, thou shalt both save thyself and those that hear thee. God knows I was heartily willing to have served him longer in the work of the ministry, although it had still been attended with all the labors and hardships of past years, if he had seen fit that it should be so. But as his will now appears otherwise, I am fully content and can with the utmost freedom say, the will of the Lord be done. It affects me to think of leaving you in a world of sin. My heart pities you that those storms and tenses are yet before you, from which I trust through grace I am almost delivered. But God lives, and blessed be my rock. He is the same almighty friend, and will, I trust, be your guide and helper, as he has been mine. And now, my dear brother, I commend you to God and to the word of his grace, which is able to build you up and give you inheritance among all them that are sanctified. May you enjoy the divine presence, both in private and public, and may the arms of your hands be made strong by the right hand of the mighty God of Jacob, which are the passionate desires and prayers of your affectionate dying brother, David Brennan. At this season also, while I was confined at Boston, I read with care and attention some papers of old Mr. Shepherd's, lately come to light and designed for the press, and I was desired and greatly urged, made some corrections where the sense was left dark for want of a word or two. Besides this, I had many visitants with whom I was able to speak. I always conversed of the things of religion, and was peculiarly assisted in distinguishing between the true and false religion of the times. There is scarcely any subject which has been matter of controversy of late, but I was at one time or another compelled to discuss and show my opinion respecting it, and that frequently before numbers of people. Especially I discoursed repeatedly on the nature and the necessity of humiliation, self-emptiness, or full conviction of a person's being utterly undone in himself, which is necessary in order to a saving faith, and the extreme difficulty of being brought to this, and the great danger there is of persons taking up with some self-righteous appearance of it. The danger of this I especially dwelt upon, being persuaded that multitudes perish in this hidden way, and because so little is said from most pulpits to discover any danger here, so that persons, being never effectually brought to die in themselves, are never truly united to Christ, and so perish. I also discoursed much on what I take to be the essence of true religion, endeavoring plainly to describe that godlike temper and disposition of soul, and that holy conversation of behavior which may justly claim the honor of having God for its original and patron. I have reason to hope God blessed my way of discoursing and distinguishing to some, both ministers and people, so that my time was not wholly lost. He was much visited while in Boston by many persons of considerable note and character, and by some of the first rank, who showed him uncommon respect, and appeared highly pressed and entertained with his conversation. Besides being honored with the company and respected ministers of the town, he was visited by several ministers from various parts of the country. He took all opportunities to discourse on the peculiar nature and distinguishing characteristics of true spiritual and vital religion, and to bear his testimony against the various false appearances of it, consisting in or arising from impressions on the imagination, sudden and supposed immediate suggestions of truth not contained in the Scripture, and that faith, which consists primarily in a person believing that Christ died for him in particular, etc. What he said was, for the most part, heard with uncommon attention and regard, and his discourses and reasonings appeared manifestly to have great weight and influence with many, with whom he conversed, both minister and others. Footnote: I have had advantage for the more full information of his conduct and conversation, the entertainment he met with, and what passed relating to him while in Boston, as he was constantly attended during his continuance there by one of my children, in order to his assistance in his illness. End of the footnote. The Honorable Commissioner in Boston of the Incorporated Society in London for Propagating the Gospel in New England and parts adjacent having newly had committed to them a legacy of the late Reverend and famous Dr. Daniel Williams of London for the support of two missionaries to the heathen, were pleased while he was in Boston to consult him about a mission to those Indians called the Six Nations, particularly about the qualifications requisite in a missionary to those Indians. They were so satisfied with his sentiments on his head and had such confidence in his faithfulness, his judgment, and discretion in things of this nature that they desired him to undertake to find and recommend two persons fit to be employed in this business, and very much left the matter with him. Several pious and generously disposed gentlemen in Boston, moved by the wonderful narrative of his labors and success among the Indians in New Jersey, and more especially by their conversation with him on the same subject, took opportunity to inquire more particularly into the state and necessities of his congregation and the school among them, with a charitable intention of contributing something to promote the excellent designs of advancing the interests of Christianity among the Indians. Understanding that there was a want of Bibles for the school, 36 Bibles were immediately procured, and 14 L in bills of the old tenure given over and above, besides more large benefactions made afterwards, which I shall have occasion to mention in their proper place. Brennan's restoration from his extremely low state in Boston, so as to go abroad again and to travel, was very unexpected to him and his friends. My daughter, who was with him, writes thus concerning him in a letter dated June 23rd. Quote, "On Thursday he was very ill, with a violent fever and extreme pain in his head and breast, and at turns delirious. So he remained till Saturday evening, when he seemed to be in the agonies of death. The family was up with him till 1 or 2 o'clock, expecting that every hour would be his last. On Sabbath day he was a little revived. His head was better, but very full of pain and exceeding sore at his breaths, but much put to it for breath, etc. Yesterday he was better upon all accounts. Last night he slept but little. This morning he was much worse. Dr. Pinchcon, P-Y-N-C-H-O-N, says he has no hopes of his life, nor does he think it likely that he will ever come out of the chamber, though he says he may be able to come to Northampton," unquote. In another letter dated June 29th, she says as follows, "Mr. Brennan has not so much pain nor fever since I last wrote as before, yet he is extremely weak and low and very faint, expecting every day will be his last. He says it is impossible for him to live, for he has hardly vigor enough to draw his breath. I went this morning into town, and when I came home, Mr. Broomfield said he never expected I should see him alive, for he lay 2 hours as they thought dying. One could scarcely tell whether he was alive or not. He was not able to speak for some time, but now as much as he was before. The doctor thinks he will drop away in such a turn. Mr. Brennan says he never felt anything so much like disillusion as that he felt today, and says he never had any conception of it being possible for any creature to be alive, and yet so weak as he is from day to day. The doctor says he should not be surprised if he should so recover as to live half a year, nor would it surprise him if he should die in half a day. Since I begin to write, he is not so well, having had a faint turn again, yet patient and resigned, having no distressing fears but the contrary," unquote. His physician, the Honorable Joseph Pinchong, Esquire, when he visited him and his extreme illness in Boston, attributed his sinking so suddenly into a state so extremely low and nigh unto death to the breaking of ulcers which had been long gathering in his lungs, as Brennan himself intimates in a forementioned passage in his diary, and there discharging and diffusing their purulent matter. This, while nature was laboring and struggling to throw it off, which could be done no otherwise than by a gradual straining of it through the small vessels of those vital parts, occasioned a high fever and violent coughing through the whole frame of nature into the utmost disorder and brought it near to a dissolution. But it was supposed that the strength of nature held to the lungs had this way gradually cleared themselves of this putrid matter, he might revive and continue better, till new ulcers gathered and broke. But that would surely sink him again, and there was no hope of his recovery. He expressed himself to one of his neighbors, who at that time saw him in Boston, that he was as certainly a dead man as if he was shot through the heart. But so it was ordered in divine providence that the strength of nature held out through this great conflict, so as just to escape the grave at that turn. And then he revived, to the astonishment of all who knew his case. After he began to revive, he was visited by his youngest brother Israel, a student at Yale College, who, having heard of his extreme illness, went from thence to Boston in order to see him, if he might find him alive, which he but little expected. This visit was attended with a mixture of joy and sorrow to Brennan. He greatly rejoiced to see his brother, especially because he had desired an opportunity of some religious conversation with him before he died. But this meeting was attended with sorrow, as his brother brought to him the sorrowful tidings of his sister Spencer's death at Haddam, a sister between whom and him had long subsisted a peculiarly dear affection and much intimacy in spiritual matters, and whose house he used to make his own when he went to Haddam, his native place. He had heard nothing of her sickness till this report of her death, but he had these comforts together with the tidings, viz., a confidence of her being gone to heaven, and an expectation of his soon meeting her there. His brother continued with him till he left the town, and came with him from thence to Northampton. Concerning the last Sabbath Brennan spent in Boston, he writes in his diary as follows. Lord's Day, June 19th. I was just able to attend public worship, being carried to the house of God in a chaise. Heard Dr. Sewall preach in the forenoon, partook of the Lord's Supper at this time. In this sacrament I saw astonishing divine wisdom displayed. Such wisdom as I saw required the tongues of angels and glorified saints to celebrate. It seemed to me that I never should do anything at adoring the infinite wisdom of God, discovered in the contrivances of man's redemption, until I arrived at a world of perfection. Yet I could not help striving to call upon my soul and all within me to bless the name of God. In the afternoon, heard Mr. Prince preach. I saw more of God in the wisdom discovered in the plan of man's redemption than I saw of any other of his perfections through the whole day. He left Boston the next day, but before he came away, he had occasion to bear a very full, plain, and open testimony against that opinion that the essence of saving faith lies in believing that Christ died for me in particular, and that this is the first act of faith in a true believer's closing with Christ. He did it in a long conference he had with a gentleman who has very publicly and strenuously appeared to defend the tenet. He had this discourse with him in the presence of a number of respectable individuals who came to visit Brennan before he left the town and to take their leave of him. In this debate, he made this plain declaration, at the same time confirming what he said by many arguments, that the essence of saving faith was wholly left out of the definition which that gentleman has published, and that the faith which he has defined had nothing of God in it, nothing above nature, nor indeed above the power of the devils, and that all such as had this faith, and no better, though they might have this to never so high a degree, would surely perish. He declared also that he never had greater assurances of the falseness of the principles of those who maintain such a faith, and of their dangerous and destructive tendency, or a more affecting sense of the great delusion and misery of those who depended on getting to heaven by such a faith, while they had no better than he lately had when he was supposed to be at the point of death and expecting every moment to pass into eternity. Brennan's discourse at this time and the forcible reasonings by which he confirmed that he asserted appeared to be greatly to the satisfaction of those present, as several of them took occasion expressly to manifest to him before they took leave of him. When this conversation was ended, having bid an affectionate farewell to his friends, he set out in the cool of the afternoon on his journey to Northampton, attended by his brother and my daughter who went with him to Boston, and would have been accompanied out of the town by a number of gentlemen, besides that honorable person who gave him his company for some miles on that occasion, as the testimony of their esteem and respect, had not his aversion to anything of pomp or show prevented it. July 25th. I arrived here at Northampton, having set out from Boston on Monday, about 4 o'clock p.m. In this journey, I rode about 16 miles a day, one day with another, was sometimes extremely tired and faint on the road, so that it seemed impossible for me to proceed any further. At other times, I was considerably better and felt some freedom, both of the body and mind. Lord's Day, July 26th. This day I saw clearly that I should never be happy. Yea, that God himself could not make me happy, unless I could be in a capacity to please and glorify him forever. Take away this, and admit me in all the fine heavens that can be conceived of by men or angels, and I should still be miserable forever. End of chapter 12, part 1. There'll be another part to this.